Hi, I'm Dan Lothian, the executive producer for The World. I want to take a moment to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. Thank you. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round. Recurring gifts are especially impactful. They ensure we have the resources to be meaningful with our time, to ask consequential questions, and to dive deep into hard issues. It allows us to plan ahead so we can spend more time thinking about the coverage we'd like to bring you next week, next month, and even next year. We are aiming to raise $67,000 before the end of the year, and a generous donor has offered to match your gift one for one. Every gift gets us closer to our goal. Can we count on you? Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Once again, thank you. And now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Today on The World, Israel moves further into southern Gaza in its war against Hamas, while health conditions in the territory become untenable. International health officials warn that more Palestinians will die from disease than from bombs. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the program, the president of this year's UN Climate Summit makes a controversial comment.
There is no science out there that says that the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5.
He then retracts and says he was misrepresented. And the Oxford English Dictionary reveals its word of the year. When the word is slang, how long will it actually be around?
Words are quite ephemeral. They may sort of come in, say hello, and then just leave almost as quickly as they arrived.
Will we all get rizzed by the word rizz? Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it this Monday. For nearly 2 months now, the Israeli military and Hamas in Gaza have been at war with each other. Today at a press conference in Tel Aviv, family members of Israeli hostages still being held in Gaza called on the government's war cabinet to do more to secure their release.
We request a meeting with the war cabinet to receive updates on the fate of our family members now. Now. Not tomorrow. Now.
Doctors who have been treating the children reunited with Israeli families in the hostage deals have also been talking about the condition those youngsters are in.
They looked like shadows of children, not like children. They looked like shadows.
In the Gaza Strip, the number of Palestinians killed continues to rise. Israel's military issued evacuation orders for the southern town of Khan Yunis. That comes as the military expanded its operations into southern Gaza, forcing more people to flee further south. All of this has left Gaza's public health situation in terrible shape. Disease is spreading rapidly as fighting pushes more people into smaller areas of southern Gaza. A new report by the World Health Organization says illness could kill more civilians than the bombs being launched on Gaza. To discuss the health situation in Gaza, we're joined by Ricardo Pires, a spokesperson with UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. He joins us from Florence, Italy. Ricardo, can you describe the public health situation in southern Gaza right now? What diseases you're seeing there?
We're hearing from our colleagues on the ground that the risk of waterborne disease, especially because of the lack of proper sanitation and water systems, is the biggest threat right now. We're talking about potential diarrhea outbreaks, which lead to severe malnutrition. And we know that the numbers are already escalating a lot week after week. We're talking about comparing to the period before the escalation started to a tenfold increase in cases of severe diarrhea amongst children.
So what are the causes behind the spread of these diseases?
It's mainly the lack of proper hygiene and sanitation infrastructure. Colleagues are saying that in the safe, they call it safe zones, which are actually another part of the problem. There is no safe place for children right now. But in the places where displaced populations are being led to go, 400 people are sharing one toilet. So these are conditions that are very prone to the spread of disease through a bacteria or through contaminated water, which children are drinking because they don't have other option. They don't have safe water, drinking water, potable water to access and address their thirst. So they're thirsty, they're getting dehydrated, and they're, you know, ingesting or drinking contaminated water.
The reports about hospital and medical infrastructure generally are discouraging. Hospitals are without basics like anesthesia right now. How are the health authorities in Gaza dealing with the situation amid what's all around them, this rising death toll from the fighting?
They're struggling a lot. The hospitals are at 200% capacity. We've been receiving reports from colleagues that have been going to Al-Nasser Hospital, for example, which is the largest operational health facility right now in Gaza. And their reports are heartbreaking. They're talking about children laying on the floor with potentially deadly injuries and wounds and not being able to be attended by a healthcare worker or any person who can support them. Sometimes they're actually separated from their parents or their family. So they're there alone on the floor, bleeding, and nobody can help them because the capacity, as I said, is at 200%. So every 10 minutes, you get 50 more. And as the bombings continue and increase, actually, these numbers are going to become hard to describe. So the situation in hospitals is extremely, extremely dire.
What can organizations like the WHO or the International Committee of the Red Cross, what can they provide?
Marco, without a permanent ceasefire or even a temporary humanitarian pause as we've had before Friday, there's not much we can do other than trying to deliver the little supplies we can get through the border and make sure that they reach those children in need. But the needs have already quickly outpaced the resources. We don't have enough supplies getting in. Before October 7th, 500 trucks would cross into Gaza every day with humanitarian supplies, but also commercial goods. Right now, the most we've had is 170, less than half. So right now, we don't have the supplies to provide hospitals with what they need to support these patients. And fuel, for example, it's also very, very limited. And without fuel, they don't have electricity. So hospital machines that need to operate to keep children alive in incubators, for example, they will no longer function and these children will die.
Ricardo Pires is a spokesperson with UNICEF, speaking with us about the worsening health conditions for people in Gaza. He joined us from Florence, Italy. Thank you very much, Ricardo.
Thank you.
In Venezuela, voters approved a referendum on the government's controversial plans to reclaim the territory of Essequibo. That's a large strip of land that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean to the Amazon rainforest. The disputed land is governed by Guyana, but a few years ago, oil was discovered off Essequibo's coast. And as Manuel Reda reports, Guyana now sees the region as critical to its economy.
With a campaign song playing in the background, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro greeted his supporters at a public square in Caracas and celebrated the referendum results. Officials said that 95% of voters who went to the polls approved of the government's plans to reclaim the Essequibo territory. We have taken the first steps to take back what's ours, Maduro said, to take back what our founding fathers left for us. Voters in Venezuela were asked five questions on Sunday, including whether they rejected a 19th-century ruling by an arbitration court that awarded most of the Essequibo territory to Guyana, and also if they rejected how Guyana has recently been using the resources in the Essequibo's territorial waters. Guyana has been extracting oil from the region for the past 3 years with the help of American companies like ExxonMobil. The oil reserves there are now believed to be the largest in South America. But in spite of the region's wealth, participation in the referendum seemed to be low. Pictures shared by Venezuelan media outlets showed mostly empty voting centers. Frank Maldonado is a small business owner in the city of San Cristobal. He stayed at home because he says he believed the government was just using the referendum to stir nationalist sentiment, as President Maduro tries to get re-elected next year.
La mayoría de nosotros en Venezuela no confiamos en el régimen de Maduro, ¿no?
Most of us don't trust the Maduro regime, he says. He added that while he believes that the Essequibo should belong to Venezuela, it's a matter that should be settled in an international court. Still, the referendum has led to fears in Guyana that Venezuela might be planning to take more drastic actions in the following months, like invading the country or using its navy to block Guyana's oil projects. Michael McGarrell is an indigenous leader from the Essequibo territory. He was raised in Chinapau, a village of about 800 people.
There is a lot of fear. People are scared because, of course, you have a lot of misinformation also being peddled, like on social media.
Essequibo has a population of about 100,000 people who are mostly indigenous. McGarrell says they don't want to be taken over.
We are proud Guyanese, and of course we will continue to stand for our Essequibo because Essequibo belongs to us.
Guyana has asked the International Court of Justice to review the dispute, and the court has invited both countries to present their arguments next year. But Venezuela's government argues that the ICJ is not fit to rule on the matter, and even included a question in this weekend's referendum, asking voters whether they rejected the court's jurisdiction. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogota.
The Oxford English Dictionary has presented its word of the year, and that word is RIZZ, R-I-Z-Z. It's slang that comes into common use from Gen Zers. The origin of RIZZ, likely the second syllable in the word charisma. It can refer, though, to oh so much more, like to rizz up someone, meaning to seduce or chat them up. Apparently it took off after actor Tom Holland used it in an interview online last year.
I have no rizz whatsoever. I have limited rizz. My brother Paddy has ultimate rizz. I don't know. I need you to fall in love with me, really, for it to work.
Ultimate rizz. The rest, I guess you could say, is a rizztery. Rizz was chosen from a short list of other finalist words to get inside how these words are plucked from popular usage and added to the venerable OED. We called up Fiona McPherson. She's a senior editor at the Oxford English Dictionary. Let's start with that word rizz, Fiona. I don't know if your etymological research required watching Tom Holland say it over and over again, but who first brought the word rizz to the OED?
It's first used in internet world, basically, and on Twitch and places like that. And I think the Tom Holland interview, because it got quite widely reported, I think that brought it more into the mainstream.
Yeah, so how does this all work at the OED? Do you have an army of lexicographers scouring the world for new words and bringing them back to you? Or are there just millions of people out there just hoping they offered you the best word of the year?
So we have lexicographers who can analyse corpus. Our corpus is a big database of, it's taking news stories mostly from the web and from blogs and those kind of things. It's currently got 22 billion words in it, and it's updated
wow.
monthly. Sometimes, as the case of some of the words that we had on our short list, so one of the other ones was prompt. Now that's an old word,
yeah.
It goes back to centuries and centuries. But this year, we've seen an increase in its usage in an AI sense, as in an instruction given to an AI program, which would then determine the kind of content that you're going to get back from it.
So what actually elevates a word from a kind of ephemeral slang to a word in the dictionary?
It is down to usage. Are the people who you would expect to use them using them?
And Fiona, this year, what other words were in the running for Word of the Year?
Situationship. Do you know that word?
No, say that again.
Situationship.
Situationship, as opposed
yes.
to maybe a relationship.
Exactly. And it's a romantic relationship that isn't considered to be formal or established yet. So it's a sort of in-between situation. There you go. I didn't mean to say situation there.
Yeah, the phrase, it's complicated, doesn't work for that.
Well, that's what it reminded me of really very much. When Facebook used to, I don't know if it still does, but allow you to say your relationship status was, it's complicated. It did remind me of that.
I gather there's also beige flag was one of the runners up, adding on to many other flags like red flags. What is a beige flag, though?
Yeah, a character trait that indicates that a partner or potential partner is a bit boring or lacks originality. So, maybe that's okay sometimes. Or it's a trait or a habit that a partner or potential partner might display, which is viewed as being very characteristic of them, but it's neither really good nor bad. It's just a bit meh, maybe. Words are quite ephemeral. They may sort of come in, say hello, and then just leave almost as quickly as they arrived. But if a word does go into the OED. We don't take it out.
Fiona McPherson is a senior editor at the Oxford English Dictionary, speaking with us about the OED's word of the year. It is RIZZ, R-I-Z-Z. Fiona, thank you for taking us inside how all this works.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
The leader of the UN climate summit was already a controversial figure. Then he questioned the necessity of phasing out fossil fuels. The dust-up in Dubai, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The president of this year's UN climate summit, Sultan Al-Jaber, is making news again today, this time for comments he made in a video interview last month.
There is no science out there or no scenario out there that says that the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5. 1.5 is my North Star.
Al-Jaber was talking there about the goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. He also suggested that phasing out fossil fuels would take the world back into the caves. The Guardian covered this on Sunday, and it got a huge reaction at the climate summit in Dubai, which the world's Carolyn Beeler has been following. Carolyn, tell us more about what people have been saying in reaction.
Well, this news rippled through the COP venue in Dubai over the weekend, and sources tell me there was shock, disbelief, and anger, and scientists specifically rushed to respond with statements about the science behind this, which is that there does need to be a huge reduction in fossil fuel use in order to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, or even the probably more realistic target of 2 degrees Celsius. Sultan Al-Jaber today called a press conference at the summit venue in Dubai to say that his comments had been misrepresented.
I have said over and over that the phase down and the phase out of fossil fuel is inevitable. In fact, it is essential. And it needs to be orderly, fair, just, and responsible.
So, walking back his earlier statements, Carolyn, you mentioned that the science, as we know, is unequivocal about the need to phase out fossil fuels. Remind us what the science says.
Yeah, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, convened by the UN, says that to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by mid-century, carbon dioxide emissions have to go down by 99%. And right now, the vast majority of those CO2 emissions come from burning coal, oil, and gas. Now, if technologies to capture and store greenhouse gases mature and scale up really fast, there is a little wiggle room for a small amount of oil and gas to continue to be burned by mid-century. But it's also clear that there can't be any new development of fossil fuel resources starting now if we want to keep that 1.5 degree target within reach.
So, Carolyn, even though Al-Jaber has walked his earlier statement back, is there a sense that this could have an impact on what happens at the summit?
You know, it further undermines the credibility of the COP leadership. The president was a controversial choice from the very beginning because he's also the CEO of the United Arab Emirates State Oil Company. But ultimately, the COP will be judged on its outcomes at the end of the summit next week. Bill Hare, the director of a think tank called Climate Analytics, told me something interesting from Dubai this morning. He said that the dust had somewhat settled on all of this since a couple of days ago, and it might have actually had a productive side effect.
COPs do many different things, and some of them are quite obscure. But the big story here is that this COP needs to agree that there has to be a phase out of fossil fuels. And I think what the COP president's comments have said, have really focused everyone's attention on that's what we need to do.
Well, we'll see about that. Let's get into that, though, Carolyn. Where do countries stand on this core issue of phasing out fossil fuels?
Well over 100 countries have signed on to statements or come out in some other way in favor of a phase out or a phase down of fossil fuels. Just a note on that language, a phase out is seen as stronger language. A phase down is seen as leaving the door open to some continued burning of fossil fuels. The U.S., the EU, and many climate-vulnerable countries have come out supporting some type of language around this. But on the other hand, major countries like Russia and China have come out opposing strong phase-out language. And this is the kind of thing that's likely to come down to some late-night, last-minute negotiating in the final hours of the summit.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, thanks for keeping us up to date on the COP summit.
You're welcome, Marco.
Over the next 2 days, we'll be looking at how two different countries see the idea of fossil fuel phase-out. Tomorrow, we look to Australia, one of the largest exporters of coal and gas. Exports from Turkey to Russia have increased a lot this year, including technology that has both civilian and military uses. It is alarming for Turkey's NATO allies who oppose Russia's war in Ukraine. Last week, a high-level U.S. official warned that Turkish businesses could face additional sanctions over these exports. From Istanbul, here's the world's Duri Baskaran.
It all starts with these tiny semiconductors, microprocessors, and memory modules called chips.
Chips? Oh my God, like everything, right? There's loads of chips in your phone, your computers, your electronics, your critical infrastructure.
Emily Kilcrease is a senior fellow for the Center for New American Security and a former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative.
Your cars these days, your dishwashers, anything that has any sort of data transmitted over it will likely have some sort of chip associated with it.
And that is why it's so hard to stop them from getting into Russia for use in military hardware, Kilcrease says. There are 45 types of goods that the U.S. and European Union are tracking because of the risk they pose if sold to the Russian military. Chips are a big one. They can be used in radios, surveillance drones, even cruise missiles. And U.S.-made chips are some of the best.
The more precise your weapon system is, the more important chips and having advanced chips would be to ensuring the accuracy of your weapon system.
In this video released by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, Ukrainian forces shoot down a Russian cruise missile over the Odessa region. At least 10,000 civilians have been killed in almost 2 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Investigations by the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI, have found chips made by Texas Instruments and other Western companies inside Russian weapons recovered from the battlefield in Ukraine. So how did they get there? Most chips are sold by distributors, and it's hard to track where they end up. Some of those distributors are in Turkey, a NATO ally that did not join Western sanctions against Russia, although it has expressed opposition to the war.
Every time, inevitably, what happens is the Turkish economy suffers because it's in our neighborhood.
Mustafa Aydin is a security and geopolitical expert at Kadir Has University in Istanbul. He says that, as a matter of principle, the Turkish government does not join sanctions against individual countries because it's usually against a neighbor, like Syria, Iran, Russia.
Turkey reasons that we will be here after the sanction ends and the countries who are sanctioning leave.
Turkey has expressed support for Ukraine, but according to data compiled by Bruegel, a Belgian think tank, Turkish companies have also increased sales of goods to Russia that are subject to export bans. And they've increased sales to Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Those countries haven't reported a similar rise in imports, which, according to experts, could mean that they're being used as pass-through countries to Russia.
Respectable companies do not do this kind of things.
The U.S. has sanctioned several Turkish companies it says have sold chips and other sensitive products to Russia. And it's also putting direct pressure on the Turkish government to prevent these sales. But Aydin says tracking where these goods come from and where they're going is complicated.
And usually it's more like an intelligence operation rather than police operation.
A request for comment to the Turkish Foreign Ministry was not returned. But the government has said that it strictly complies with efforts to prevent sales of sensitive products to Russia. Emily Kilcrease, the former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative, says the U.S. sanctions regime doesn't work perfectly, but she thinks it's still making things harder for Russia in its war against Ukraine.
They're getting like lower quality chips, and it's harder and more expensive for them to get them. That matters. It may not be as strong of an effect as policymakers initially wanted, but the fact is that we are still imposing costs.
Whether it's enough to help Ukraine win the war, Kilcrease says, is a much harder question to answer. For the world, I'm Dari Buzgarin, Istanbul, Turkey.
In the week since the October Hamas attacks, more Israelis have been buying guns to protect themselves.
People don't feel safe, so there's a very real concern and demand by the average Israeli to arm themselves.
Palestinians living in Israel don't have the same right to own guns.
It's very scary, actually, for us.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Israeli war against Hamas has spilled over into the Red Sea. Yesterday, the Houthi-run government of Yemen fired missiles at commercial ships off its coastline. A U.S. battleship, the USS Kearney, fired back. The U.S. military says the carny shot down three drones in self-defense during several hours of assaults. The Yemeni government says that, in solidarity with Hamas, it is stopping Israeli ships from navigating the Red Sea. It's an escalation of attacks on shipping vessels directly related to the war. The U.S. Department of Defense put out a press release saying, quote, attacks represent a direct threat to international commerce and maritime security. Catherine Zimmerman has been following all this. She's with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Catherine, the Carney shot down three Houthi drones yesterday. What is the USS Carney's mission in the Red Sea?
The USS Carney is in the Red Sea nominally to protect U.S. interests, to keep the commercial commerce flowing through that strategic maritime choke point, and also to help serve as a defensive reinforcement for the U.S. forces in the Middle East region after the escalation with the Israel-Hamas war.
Do we know if the USS Carney was intentionally targeted by the drone attacks?
It's not clear, and the Defense Department has issued statements repeatedly, both this weekend and previously, that it's not clear whether or not they were being directly targeted. The Carney was responding to distress calls, which means that it was in the vicinity of the commercial ships that the Houthis were certainly targeting. And the accuracy of their missiles are not always precise, so it could be that the Carney was simply caught in some crossfire.
What is the goal of the Houthis in these attacks?
The goal is clearly to participate in an escalation against Israel because of the conflict inside of Gaza against Hamas. And the Houthis have joined with other Iranian-backed groups in the region to fire missiles directly at Israel, to contest the waterways, and to punish Israel for what the Houthis are saying is an escalation against the Palestinian people. The entire point of this is to force Israel to back down, to compel the United States to draw out of the region or to escalate directly, to make this costly for both Israel and the United States as the U.S. supports Israel's right to defend itself.
The Pentagon says, we also have every reason to believe that these attacks, while launched by the Houthis in Yemen, are fully enabled by Iran. Catherine, what is the Iranian role here?
The Iranians may not be directly commanding the Houthis to conduct these attacks, but they have provided the Houthis with every weapon that is being used in the attacks, as well as the capabilities to use them. And if you look at the pattern of Iranian engagement with the Houthis, it has always been with an eye toward us opening a second front against Israel, using Yemen as a staging ground and being able to contest both the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is one of the most strategic choke points, maritime choke points in the world, as well as creating this expansion of Iranian influence through the region.
As you know, we've heard U.S. officials say they want to make sure the war in Gaza does not become a regional war. So do these events this weekend show that it already is a regional war?
The challenge that the U.S. and even Israel faces with what the Iranian-backed groups are doing is that they are trying to make this much more of a regional conflict in order to really compel both Israel and the U.S. to back down, because nobody wants a regional war. I think the real challenge is that the way that the United States has historically responded to threats such as these is direct targeting at the source of the threat. Clearly, the escalation from the Houthis, which have no real relationship with Hamas other than a rhetorical support and general support for the Palestinian people, for them to come into the war is an expansion of the conflict.
The Houthis still control Yemen's Red Sea coastline, and the U.S. is still escorting ships there. How likely do you see this escalating further?
The Houthis certainly have the capabilities to do so. They have developed stockpiles of sea mines. They have clearly identified how to contest commercial traffic. And the real question is, if the U.S. were to respond, whether that response would actually eliminate the key capabilities the Houthis have, the radar sites, the weapon and missile sites that enable them to fire drones and missiles at commercial ships.
I mean, as you said, the Houthis are trying to work their Iran connections, but is Iran going to support them as far as they'd like to go in the Red Sea?
The Iranian Navy has been harassing U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf for the past year at least. And this maritime escalation is on track with some of Iran's strategic interests, which is really to establish Iranian hegemony over the region, including that waterway. The question is whether the Houthis are going to miscalculate and escalate this beyond the level that Iran is comfortable with. Clearly, that conversation has to happen in Tehran. It also needs to be happening here in Washington about what we do. Should we see an inflection point in the conflict?
Catherine Zimmerman is a scholar and advisor to the Critical Threats Project of the American Enterprise Institute. She was updating us on attacks in the Red Sea by Yemen's Houthi military on commercial shipping and the U.S. response. Catherine, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
The anger across much of the Arab world and beyond over Israel's war on Gaza has led to a boycott campaign that's gaining momentum. In Jordan, many people have stopped buying American and European brands that they say support Israel financially or have a pro-Israel stance. Starbucks and McDonald's in Amman, for example, are mostly empty these days. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports from the Jordanian capital, in supermarkets, everyday items now carry warnings.
At the Shoni supermarket in Amman, products have two kinds of labels. One announces the price, the other, in red, alerts the customer if the product is on a list of boycotted items.
Nivea, Dove, Colgate.
The red label reads, "Be aware, these products are boycotted. Your choice." This is a grassroots effort. There's not just one list of boycotted items. They're all over social media.
They have an Israeli factory in the Israeli town of Migdal HaEmek, which was once a Palestinian village called Al-Mujadil.
The boycott movement against Israel and supporters of Israel is not new. But since the start of the war in Gaza, it's been gaining new supporters across countries in the Middle East and elsewhere. Rania Zaid is shopping for her family. She used to buy chocolate, sneakers and Nescafe for her kids, but she stopped since the war started. She says every time she comes to the store, she looks at the packaging. If it says the product is made in the US or Europe, she doesn't buy it. Even if it's something simple and small, it's what we can do, she says. This way our minds are at ease that we're not supporting the war. Many here and in other Arab countries say that Israel's war on Gaza would not be possible without the backing of the US and some European countries, where many of these big corporations are based. Both McDonald's and Starbucks have issued statements trying to distance themselves from this conflict. But that has had little effect here. Hassan Abu Qaoud is the store supervisor at the Ma'ruf Cafe in Amman. He says he left his job at Starbucks about 3 weeks ago and came here. Abu Qaoud tells me he could no longer work for a company that, as he sees it, has a pro-Israel stance.
I want to leave because I feel that I have to do something for the boycott, to support the Palestinian people also.
His former colleagues tell him sales have dropped significantly, and now those employees are considering leaving too. This shift in consumer behavior has had some benefits for local businesses. Anas Abu Ode is the owner of Ma'ruf Coffee Company. He tells me he's seen a 30% increase in sales since the war began.
So we add more staff, we add more stock, yeah, and actually we add more 100 employees in our staff for this period.
They added 100 more employees, he says. At the same time, the head of Jordan's labor observatory, Ahmed Awad, said this week that about 15,000 people could lose their jobs as a result of these boycotts. Suad al-Dawood switched from Starbucks to the local Ma'ruf Cafe. She says the boycott movement has helped her pay more attention to what she buys.
When I go to the market, I look at the product itself and read. And sometimes I open Google and check what is this country, the company, which country is from. Or when it's something related to English, like UK, US, French, I left it.
Not everyone is convinced, Dawood says. Her father, for example, doesn't think the boycott movement will make much difference. Dawood disagrees.
When we keep pushing and supporting and protesting, definitely something big will happen.
Dawood, who's a pediatric dentist, says she planned to go to the U.S. to study. But the U.S.'s support for Israel has changed her mind.
I used to love, to admire, and I used to have a dream to go there and do some, like, a PhD or more clinical attachment there. And I'm now not even surprised. No, I need to say something bad. Disgust. I'm disgusted.
She's disgusted, she says, that the U.S. is not doing more to stop the deaths in Gaza. Dawood says she will continue with her boycott. In fact, she says she doesn't see herself going to Starbucks or McDonald's ever again. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari in Amman, Jordan.
Gun sales are on the rise in Israel after the shocking attack by Hamas on October 7th, which killed hundreds of Israeli civilians. A lot of people in Israel have decided to arm themselves. More guns in more people's hands, that can also be dangerous, as The World's Matthew Bell reports from Jerusalem.
Yuval Castleman could have been a national hero late last week when two Hamas gunmen got out of a car and started shooting people waiting at a Jerusalem bus stop. Castleman grabbed his own gun and returned fire. The two gunmen killed three people, but they were quickly shot and killed themselves. Castleman immediately realized he too was being shot at by an Israeli soldier on the scene with a rifle. In surveillance camera footage, you can see Castleman tossing his gun aside. He gets down on his knees in the middle of the street, opens up his jacket, and holds up his hands.
He really is begging for his life.
That's Myrav Zonshine with the International Crisis Group.
The specific soldier who shot him, they didn't follow even the loose rules of engagement that the IDF has and the police have in these situations, where if somebody is disarmed or unarmed and is with his hands up and is not posing a threat, then you should not be shooting at that person.
Yuval Castleman was shot three times. He died in the hospital that same night. The soldier who shot him is being questioned by authorities. The incident is getting a lot of attention because the Israeli public, since October 7th, has been rushing out to buy weapons.
Bullock 9mm, made in Israel, 15 rounds. Yeah.
Yair Yifrach owns a gun shop, shooting range, and training school outside of Jerusalem. He says he's been so busy in recent weeks, it's been impossible to keep up with demand. His training courses are double or triple booked, and he says it seems like everybody wants to buy a gun right now.
All of him. If it was the left side, the right side, the middle side, all of him.
Men, women, older, younger?
Exactly. No older, because there's still, we have rules in Israel, and it's very, very tough rules.
But after October 7th, the government loosened some of those rules, making it easier for Israeli citizens to buy weapons. This morning's gun safety class is packed. Hodiah Dahan is sitting in the back row. She tells me she's ready for the first time in her life to buy a gun.
Why now?
Because of everything that's happening.
That's my colleague Yonit Farago interpreting.
I have two kids, and I have to be sure that when I go out with them, I'm safe and no one can harm me.
Dahan says her attitude changed after October 7th.
The change was that the horrible massacre on October 7th was the understanding that they can harm children, women, pregnant women. That was the difference. And the understanding that you can't really rely on anyone to help.
That's something Shaul Yudelman tells me, too. He's been living in a West Bank settlement for years, but only recently decided to buy a gun, and he's far from alone.
The core thing is a sense of failure of security, lack of security. What people feel, what people are feeling is a tremendous sense of fear. The kibbutzim, the communities in the south that were able to repel the attacks were the ones that had guns.
And that the army and the government let people down?
They let them down, yeah. They weren't there, in a sense. And in general, in Israel, the last couple of years, a lot of attacks have been stopped by civilians who are armed.
Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, has been a big advocate of putting weapons into the hands of more Jewish Israeli civilians. That makes a lot of people uneasy, especially Palestinians. Many are not citizens and not legally allowed to buy guns. that includes much of the Palestinian population in Jerusalem.
It's very scary, actually, for us.
Ahmed Muna works at a bookshop in the commercial heart of Palestinian East Jerusalem.
Basically, normal civilians are now armed, and they don't hesitate to use their weapons. With the increased amount of weapons all around us and with the violence that is continuing to increase in our region, we don't feel safe.
Muna says he's a peaceful person. He wouldn't want to get a gun even if he were allowed to have one. And he worries that Israel's far-right government is making things worse.
Today, one minister in this government, one of many ministers in this government, that are encouraging violence and helping settlers to use violence against Palestinians.
It's not just Palestinians who are alarmed. Today, the head of Israel's gun licensing department in the National Security Ministry resigned. This followed revelations that Itamar Ben-Gvir was fast-tracking thousands of civilian gun permits. On Sunday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was asked about the rise in gun licenses and the shooting death of Yuval Castleman last week. He said more guns for civilians is a good idea because it saves lives. It could be that we will pay a price for it, Netanyahu said. That's life. Later, after the comment drew criticism, the prime minister called Castleman an Israeli hero, and he said there would be a full investigation into his death. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Jerusalem.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The tech war between China and the U.S. escalated a bit this month as China put limits on the amount of graphite it exports. Graphite is a key component in electric vehicle batteries and semiconductors, and China controls much of the global supply. The U.S. stopped mining graphite long ago, but huge reserves have been found in Alaska. Reporter Nat Herz traveled to the village of Teller, Alaska, along the Bering Sea, where a Canadian mining company wants to step in to help the U.S. become self-sufficient in graphite.
The last United States graphite mine shut down decades ago, which means the country depends on foreign supplies. But President Biden's climate bill gives big tax credits to electric vehicles that use domestically sourced minerals in their batteries. So mining companies are now searching for new deposits in the U.S. Gracelyn Baskerin is a mining economist at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We are actually just not focused on mining in a very long time, is the short of it.
Baskerin says the U.S. mining industry is like a muscle that hasn't been flexed in a long time.
We have actually turned to companies like Rio Tinto, Anglo American, BHP. We turn to these giant mining companies and sometimes we forget they're not American because they advance our American mining interests, right?
This is exactly what's happening on Alaska's Seward Peninsula, the finger of land in the western end of the state that stretches toward Russia and the Bering Strait.
So I'm here on the drill site at Graphite One.
This is U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. She recorded this video during a summer visit to a remote mining camp tucked between mountains and a huge tidal estuary. The camp belongs to a Canadian company, and with help from the American government, it could one day become the site of a mile-wide open-pit mine. Graphite One sits on the largest known deposit in the U.S. And while construction is still years away, the project is getting a Defense Department grant of nearly $40 million to speed up its development and some high-profile political attention from officials like Murkowski.
If we're going to talk electric vehicles, if we're going to talk about the contents of your cell phone, you're going to want graphite and you're going to want American graphite, and why not Alaskan graphite?
But some of the people who live closest to the proposed mine would rather see the graphite stay in the ground. There are two indigenous Inupiaq villages nearby, one that's only accessible by plane or boat. The nearest full-sized grocery store is 70 miles away, so many residents subsist on harvests of salmon, moose, and berries in the vicinity of Graphite One's project. Gilbert Toktu is president of the tribal government in the village of Brevig Mission.
The further they go into the mine, our subsistence is just going to move further and further away from us. And sooner or later, it's going to become a question, do I want to live here anymore, or do I have to make a choice to move?
Graphite itself isn't toxic, but the company is still examining whether mining it could generate heavy metals. Dave Chambers leads the Montana-based Center for Science in Public Participation, which provides technical assistance to tribal and advocacy groups on mining issues. He says the mining techniques under consideration pose a relatively low risk, but that doesn't mean no risk.
There is always a possibility for some sort of catastrophic failure, but that doesn't happen very often. There's also a possibility there would be no impact. That doesn't happen very often either.
Some residents of the nearby villages say they're open to the development.
If it's good and clean, you know, so be it. It's money.
Nick Topcock doesn't oppose Graphite One. He takes a break from hanging salmon to dry on the beach in his village of Teller to explain why. 4 in 10 residents live in poverty in Teller, and Topcock says a mine would create jobs in a place that needs them badly. He says it also might help the town finally get running water and sewer systems for the homes there. Right now, nearly everyone in town uses what's known as honey buckets for their toilets.
It's money for 50 years or more. I'll be dead by then, but it'll impact my kids financially.
Topcock's kids aren't in Teller right now. He says they moved away because there are no jobs in the village. He's done some work driving boats for Graphite One in the past, and he thinks the mine can coexist with the locals and with their harvests of fish and game.
I mean, you know, for instance, in Anchorage, Alaska, you got moose running around, you got bears running around. They'll be adapted, you know. It's going to take a year or two, and they'll be right there, you know.
Graphite One's mine, if it's opened, would benefit the area economically. A regional indigenous-owned corporation recently said it would invest $2 million in the project, but ultimately it's a foreign mining company that will be calling the shots, because Graphite One has the mining rights to the land, not indigenous corporations or tribal governments. Graphite One's Canadian chief executive, Anthony Houston, points out that the project would come with other benefits: training, jobs, and college scholarships.
So I think to myself, what can I do to give the potential for a job one day, the potential to be able to put gas in their skidoo, to be able to live and work and stay in their village, if that's what they choose to do. And that's where I see Graphite One really stepping in.
Houston says he understands the importance of protecting the environment and local subsistence harvests. And the company has spent some money to back up that commitment. Earlier this year, it made the decision to fly in fuel to its remote camp rather than barging it through an environmentally sensitive channel, which would have been cheaper. But objections remain. Conservation groups have challenged other large Alaska mining projects in the courts, and at least one has already expressed opposition to Graphite One. Company officials say they expect intense battles over permitting in the years to come. For the world, I'm Nat Herz in Teller, Alaska.
Your mouth floats above my bed at night.
The Icelandic artist Björk wrote the song Oral back in the late 1990s. She never felt it worked on any of her albums, and then it kind of slipped into the back of her archives until Björk was reminded of the song earlier this year. It was around the same time a report came out about the harm posed by poorly regulated salmon farms on Iceland's ecosystems. It prompted Björk to use the song to fight back. She enlisted Spanish superstar Rosalía to join her in the cause.
Just because.
The song itself doesn't reference fish, but proceeds from its sales will go to help Icelandic towns that have taken an economic hit from the fish farm's effect on local wildlife. For the aid campaign, Björk and Rosalía pulled one line from the chorus and looped it. Is that the right thing to do? They ask. As for the song itself, critics say it's one of the most accessible that Björk has put out in years. That's going to do it for today's show. The World Comes to You from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for being with us.
Hi there. Just a moment before you go. We know that there are so many competing requests for your time and resources right now. especially as we head toward the end of the year. So thank you for being with us day in and day out as we deliver the best in international journalism with nuance and care. We are grateful to count you among our listeners. Your notes of support are a bright spot in our day. Thank you. If you haven't yet, there is still time to give. And as we head into 2024, your support is more important than ever. So if you can, I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.